The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello. There is a pleasure to be had in watching a film come together and achieve perfection. If not perfection overall, then in enough individual scenes strung together that it goes on a kind of run that appears to approach perfection. It's like watching a great athlete, a football player, weaving through the defenders for an improbable run, or a three-point shooter who suddenly can't miss. In this case, it's the movie The Graduate, starring young Dustin Hoffman and directed by an almost new director, Mike Nichols. Based on a novel by Charles Webb, a disaffected graduate of Williams College, The Graduate is an almost timeless movie. Almost is a key word. We'll talk about that. It's nearly perfect, and it has endured. Fresh, exciting, inventive, poignant, hilarious, memorable. Routinely listed as one of the greatest comedies in movie history, and as one of the greatest debut performances, and as one of the greatest soundtracks. The Simon and Garfunkel folk rock duo, with their first album overlaying perfectly on the California ennui and angst. It's the movie that out Wes Anderson's all the Wes Andersons who came after, a seemingly effortless piece of philosophical comedy that's been working its magic on audiences since 1967. I was hoping to do this episode a week or two ago to time it with graduation season and all those graduation speeches, and I'm a little late, but in a way that's perfect, isn't it? Because this isn't about graduation, but about a graduate. It's the moment, the days, weeks, months, maybe years after graduation. Who is this person, and what is he or she supposed to do now? And what if the thing to do is not clear? And if the things to do proposed by others are not at all where the graduate wants to go? We're going to talk about The Graduate then and now, the novel and the movie, what it means to grow old with it. Roger Ebert grew old with this movie and fell out of love with it. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Mike Nichols and Charles Webb, the surprising author, and I'll tell you all about my viewings and readings of The Graduate today on The History of Literature. Hello, hello, hello. Here we go. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Jack Wilson. The Graduate. Oh, is that literature? Yes, indeed. It qualifies. This is a movie that deserves that accolade. A film, let us say, or in other words, more than just a movie, but a movie too. More than 50 years old, and it's worth our time. Now, don't worry if you haven't seen it or if you haven't read the book. Most people haven't read the book. But don't worry, in either case, I'll explain all you need to know. But if you haven't seen it, I recommend checking it out currently on Amazon Prime if you have that, and findable elsewhere if you don't. The Graduate tells the story. It's iconic, really. You probably know it from cultural references to it, even if you haven't seen it. I watched it with both of my sons at different times, and they recognize things from The Simpsons and so on. They both loved it, too, by the way. It's not one of those movies that Dad has to drag them toward. While I do drag them there, I guess, like horses to the proverbial water, but I don't have to fight to make them drink. They drank up the movie with pleasure. I think you will like this movie, too. The Graduate tells the story of a young man, a college graduate, returning to Los Angeles after finishing up at his school in the East, unnamed, I think, in both the movie and the book, from what I can recall. It's just a school out East, an Eastern college. He did well when he was there, and his parents have bought him a sports car as a celebration. He's got a scholarship and a graduate school stint lined up in a school out East, but for now he's disaffected and he's not sure what to do with his life. there in this California suburb. So he begins having an affair with Mrs. Robinson, an older woman, a family friend. In fact, the wife of his father's business partner. And then he falls in love with Mrs. Robinson's daughter, Elaine. And even if you haven't seen the film, you might know some of the lines. The one where the man pulls him aside at the party and says, "I have one word for you, Benjamin. Are you ready? Are you ready to hear it? Plastics." That's one of the few lines in the screenplay that's not in the novel. "And Mrs. Robinson, I think you're trying to seduce me." Another famous line. And the shot of Benjamin standing in the hotel room, framed by the leg of Mrs. Robinson, her bent knee is shot in close-up like an arch. And he's in the background like a forlorn visitor to some strange land. It's simply iconic. The camera work is inventive. "We did a lot of crazy camera shit," Mike Nichols said years later. But you can get away with that if the story is compelling, and it is. Every scene in this movie is propulsive. The book is like that too. Pulls you along. The camera work also makes the story better. It not only develops the themes of the film and helps tell the story, acting on the viewer in a subconscious way, but it covers for one of the key issues, I'll say, maybe problems with the novel, which is that the author gives the protagonist no inner life whatsoever. It's written like a movie in some ways. It's all exterior, pretty much. It's a lot of time to spend with one protagonist and not get inside his mind at all. All told through dialogue and stage directions. The result is a novel that is fascinating for filmgoers, but kind of a tough read too. I read an Amazon review that said, "This author can't write. There's no description." But there is plenty of description. We see Benjamin Braddock picking up a piece of paper and crumpling it and putting it into his pocket, or getting into his car and turning it on and driving down the highway, and description of facial expressions during dialogue, pauses, gestures, standing up, sitting down, turning to face, turning away, etc. But no, I think what the reviewer is trying to identify, has noticed but hasn't quite diagnosed, is that there's nothing about what's going on in Benjamin Braddock's mind, unless he says it out loud to someone. That's the absence in the novel. The effect is one of a zombie or a robot that we're following around, drifting through life like a machine that occasionally opens its mouth to let us know that the machine is not happy with how things are going. It's not a machine, it's a person. He wants something else, but doesn't know what that something else is. And translated to the screen, where Dustin Hoffman plays the character flat, the movie could be highly inert. We know what he's trying to accomplish, but we don't really know why. It's deadening because he's deadened. The soundtrack and camera movements and angles give it that extra life. The movie is alive to the world, even if Benjamin Braddock is numb. That's not easy to pull off. I don't think the novel does. The novel is not a classic. The movie is. For one thing, because of this direction, which is so inventive and interesting, it opens us to the possibilities of art. But another thing is Dustin Hoffman. Mike Nichols talked about this. He said he's got that alchemy, that magic. He's lucky to have it, Dustin Hoffman is. Something happens in the lab overnight with Dustin Hoffman. You watch him acting out this is Mike Nichols talking. You watch him acting out the scenes when you're filming, and you think, okay, he's playing it drab, he's playing it flat. And then when you see it on the screen, you see something else. Something else has happened. The camera likes him in this way. And you see a whole world behind it. You see paranoia. You see anxiety. You see that coming across, even if you didn't see it in the room when you were there watching the scene being filmed. So, that's a big part of it. That It's enjoyable to watch the actors, whereas the novel doesn't have that. It's also enjoyable to listen to the soundtrack. The novel doesn't have that either. So, okay, I'll give you one, just one moment, and then we'll do some literary news and then really dive into what makes this movie great and what it's like to grow old with it, to watch it at different times in one's life. Roger Ebert, I mentioned him already, he famously wrote a positive review when the film came out, when Roger Ebert was quite young himself. And then years later, he revisited the movie and rewrote his review, wrote a more negative one. That's pretty rare, to reconsider a classic and find it worse the second time around. Usually it works in the other direction. We'll talk about that in the context of reading and rereading novels and revisiting other works of art and why Roger Ebert fell out of love with this movie. It's a little bit different. I've grown old with this movie too, and I will have some thoughts, but my take is a little different from Roger's. I'll have some thoughts on how the movie has held up and not, where in particular it hasn't and why. But first, let's have our literary news. We'll do that after the break. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, our literary news today is not exactly literary. It comes from the world of travel and international cuisine, and that is literary in this case, and let me explain why I think that is true. I get this question from sponsors as well, would-be sponsors, who ask, well, why the history of literature? We're looking for people who travel. That's the audience we're trying to reach with our product. And yes, I guess you could say that literature is about people at home, people reading in the comfort of their easy chair or in their bed or maybe at a desk or something. Is that the stereotype of literature and literary people and readers? Because I don't think that way at all about books. I enjoy books under the covers or quilt or next to the fireplace and all that. Books can be cozy experiences, but reading for me is so active. First of all, it's kind of a cliche to say it, but we go on a journey every single time we open a book. We're in Kathmandu and Mumbai and San Francisco and Alaska and Chile. There we go, another poem, this time in South Africa. Here's a novel that takes us to Beijing. And here are authors who encourage us, by their example, to go see those places that they're writing about, to see Ireland and Paris and the Great Plains of Nebraska. I want to go to those places, and I do go whenever I can, not just in the world of literature, but in the real world, too. I learn languages because of literature. I see places because of literature. If you love literature, you're open to travel. I think that's a pretty good bet. Anyway, the Venn diagram circles are close overlaps. Which brings me to the news. This comes from the Guardian newspaper. Lunch of suffering. That's the headline. That's in quotes. Lunch of suffering. Plain white people food goes viral in China. Social media platforms inundated with users amused and bemused by raw vegetables and cold sandwiches. That's our subhead. Okay, I love stuff like this. I love hearing about other cultures, and I love hearing about how other cultures think about my culture. If it can be called a culture, what was that line? Was it Gandhi? What do you think of Western culture? And he said, I think it would be a good idea. I think I've got that right. My cousin, when he was learning Chinese in college, told me that his teacher had told him that just as American kids who are pretending to be Bruce Lee or whatever speak in a kind of shouty way, you know what I'm talking about, if you're imitating an old kung fu movie or something. I won't do it, but imagine a kid pretending to be a kung fu star. Well, kids in China who were pretending to speak English when they were on the playground would speak like this. Without the tones. In other words, Chinese is a tonal language. English is not. The sound of English to their ears ran together like a drone, a kind of droning way. It kind of reminds me of the Greeks. That's our word barbarism, by the way. Bar, 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 bar. That's how the sound sounded to them of other languages. I love hearing that. It teaches me something about myself. I love imagining what an alien being would think if they saw something that I do as a matter of routine. Would they think it was bizarre that I get in a car and turn on music and drive to an underground parking garage and take an elevator to a store where I buy groceries and return home? I learned when I was in Italy. That seems pretty basic, right? Wouldn't you expect aliens to do that too? Well, not necessarily. Maybe they get their food another way. I learned when I was in Italy that Americans were viewed as freakishly obsessed with eating while moving. Fast food, eaten in cars, was a kind of obscenity to them. Slow down. Prepare your food. Enjoy your food. Enjoy your life. I read an essay where they said, when I was in America, I saw a man eating while walking down the sidewalk. And I think, yeah, I've done that. Sometimes you're in a hurry to get where you're going. You grab a hot dog or something. You gotta get some sustenance, but you're also in a hurry. That made me stop and think, well, am I doing this wrong? That is a little weird. Meals are a necessity. One view of them is, well, this drags me down. Slows me down. I'll get through it as fast as I can so I can get on with life. Another view is, well, it's a necessity, so you might as well make the best of meals. Enjoy them. Make them a good part of your day, beneficial to your health and mental well-being. Right? One view says it's a waste of time, so I'll make sure it only takes 5 minutes. The less time, the better. Another view says, why waste even 5 minutes? Why not treat a meal with proper frame of mind so it's not a waste at all? It's a good part of your day. I love that kind of thing. And books open me up to these ideas too. So I hope you see the connection now, why this article jumped out at me as one worth sharing as part of our literary news. Back to the article. Quote, under a photo of processed cheese, ham, and crackers packed neatly in plastic, a Chinese website user writes that to eat this for lunch is to, quote, learn what it feels like to be dead, end quote. The post is part of a trend among Chinese social media users who are recreating Bai Ren Fan, or white people food, to better understand or poke fun at Western-packed lunches made up of plain ingredients such as raw vegetables and sliced meats. The article talks about videos of people eating from a bag of lettuce or raw sliced mushrooms purchased from a supermarket. The TikTok user Li2Dog breaks down white people food into three parts, says the article. First, it has no spices, quote, zero feeling to your food, end quote, because it does not prioritize enjoyment. Second, it involves as little preparation as possible. Eat it raw, eat it as a whole piece. And third, it is eaten at work or school. The idea is when you get off work, you go back to eat your normal food and you feel the life coming back. They then talk about Chinese people cooking with a lot of different ingredients, and that complexity of spices and tastes makes it impossible to imagine the point of eating, say, ham out of a package with a chased down by a packet of mustard. The article continues, to some Chinese netizens, this kind of food is the lunch of suffering, as put by blogger Shan Yule, who bought a pack of string beans and a tomato to see what it was like to eat them raw. It's a great quote. Quote, it's so lawless and outrageous, end quote. Another blogger opined that these lunches are not for enjoyment, but to find guilt. Chinese people in Europe have shared similar assessments, with one person in Germany saying they have a colleague whose lunch has not changed for 10 years. It is a handful of oatmeal mixed with low-fat yogurt with half an apple and a carrot. If such a meal is to extend life, what is the meaning of life? End quote. Now, that last part with the German lunch eater makes me think of something related, which is the people who want to reduce decision making. I read about an executive at a software company who wears the same thing every single day, khaki pants and a blue button-down Oxford shirt every single day. In his closet, that's all he has. They're lined up. Dozen pairs of pants, khaki pants, all khaki pants, and a dozen sky blue Oxford shirts. It's the perfect outfit, he said. These are the colors of the beach, sand and water, or sand and sky. And what he loves about it is that he doesn't have to choose in the morning. He doesn't have to worry about how to match his clothes. He doesn't have to wonder what's in the laundry or what's clean. This supply is always there for him. He puts them on, easy, done. And I get into grooves like that sometimes. I like oatmeal with raisins and cinnamon. I can buy all three in bulk. That's breakfast. Maybe a banana if I've got one on hand. Soy milk feels great. Three meals a day. You got to eat three meals, right? Well, it's nice to have one of them in place when I need it. You don't need to think. It's just there. Oh, feel a little stirring in my stomach. Time to go get breakfast. But I agree that when I do that 10 days, 20 days in a row, it's a little bit of a lost opportunity too. So I mix it up with cereal or granola and yogurt, sometimes eggs, toast, which is all also white people food, I guess. But I can get my fill of other more exotic and elaborate dishes elsewhere. And that's how I view food and why this reminds me of literature and travel. Literature lovers, well, I suppose there are some curmudgeons who like reading one thing over and over and don't want to ever change. And that one thing might be something close to home. Maybe it's a detective story set in the same familiar precinct. And you read a whole series over and over, that kind of thing. This is my guy. This is my author. This is my thing. Or maybe you only like an author who's local and you're proud of him or her and you think, nope, I'm not getting out of my comfort zone. But I doubt it. I doubt if you're listening to this show that that's you. And maybe you like bland food for whatever reason and you repeat your meals for whatever reason, for health or convenience or stubborn tastes or whatever, but I doubt it. I would guess you like exploring the cuisines of the world the way I do and finding the pleasures of of Mexican food and Ethiopian food and Indian and Chinese and Italian and Peruvian and Chicago style and New York style and Japanese food and San Francisco style, New England style, everything else. Because it's all so tasty. Thai food, delicious, essential. And poetry, world poetry, essential. It's an act of travel to eat these foods, and done well, done right, an act of empathy. Just like literature is an act of empathy, it stretches you into a place where there's more room for the empathy to come flooding in. You're putting yourself in someone else's position, eating dumplings that I bought on the street in Taiwan. Noodles. This is what it's like, slightly, to be here, to be living here. When you hear how you sound to other cultures, or how you look, or how you seem, that's another occasion for self-examination and also for empathy. Empathy in reverse. They're imagining what it's like to be you, and you can imagine what it's like to be them, imagining what it's like to be you. And somewhere in all this, you'll learn a little more about who you are and how you fit. We can't always know why we're here, which is the big question. But knowing who we are and how we fit can be a close approximation. That's Literary News. The Graduate, after this. The Graduate began as a novel by Charles Webb. We'll have more on him later. A producer bought it for $1,000 and sent it to Mike Nichols, who was then mostly famous for being half of the comedy team Nichols and May, who are still incredibly funny, and I'm not just saying that because they started at the University of Chicago. Their best skits are as funny as anything you'll see today, I promise. As funny and as smart. Nichols got a bit controlling as the two had success, and Elaine May had ambitions to do a little more acting and so on, and so she broke up the group, and Nichols found himself lost for a while, and then he became a theater director, where he felt like he found his calling, and then a movie director. He is extremely underrated. His movies are intelligent and funny and very well directed. People don't talk about Mike Nichols as much as they should. It didn't take long for him to find his way as a movie director. His first offer was The Graduate, but he held off because he also had the chance to direct Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. He also was having a hard time finding a screenwriter who got The Graduate the way he did. I think he went through three or four before he finally found a comedic actor, then unknown as a writer, but who would soon become very well known for both his comic appearances and his writing, Buck Henry. Buck Henry got what Nichols did. They shared a sensibility about the film. They wrote the script together, and Nichols started casting and rehearsing, and they made the movie. Now, what's so interesting about the struggle to find the right screenplay writer is that the very beginning of the screenplay, the very first scene, the one you'd think they took the most care to get right, is not in the movie at all. I don't know if they even shot it. The book begins like this. Benjamin Braddock graduated from a small Eastern college on a day in June. Then he flew home. The following evening, a party was given for him by his parents. And that's it. The party begins. Chapter one is the party. Really, the book begins with that third sentence. The following evening, a party was given for him by his parents. Benjamin doesn't want to be at the party. He's finding it hard to cope with his parents and his parents' friends. And he meets Mrs. Robinson, and we are off to the races. The movie really begins with the second sentence. Then he flew home. We start with Benjamin on the plane, landing in Los Angeles, and famously, he's on the moving walkway for an interminably long time as the credits flash on the screen and Simon and Garfunkel plays. The screenplay, the part that wasn't shot, starts with the novel's first sentence, Benjamin Braddock graduating from the small Eastern college on a day in June. We see him in the screenplay. The movie opens, the screenplay opens with him at the ceremony. In fact, he's giving a speech and he can't figure out how to finish it. Here's part of the speech that he gives. Quote, "And today it is right that we should ask ourselves the one most important question. What is the purpose of these years? The purpose for all this demanding work? The purpose for the sacrifices made by those who love us? Were there not a purpose, then all of these past years of struggle, of fierce competition, and of uncompromising ambition would be meaningless. But of course there is a purpose, and I must tell it to you. I ask you to remember this purpose always, and I pledge that I shall endeavor to carry it with me forever." End quote. That's a lot of words for Benjamin Braddock to deliver. He's pretty terse for most of the movie. That would have been quite a way for him to open the movie. Maybe that's why they didn't include that scene. The joke is that the students are watching. He's on the stage. He starts to sweat. He's stumbling. The purpose is, and so on. And the joke is that he doesn't have one. He can't deliver it. Now, that's a little on the nose, right? That screams out, disaffected college student, has no idea what the meaning of life is. Maybe he's a little full of himself, do you think? If you watch a movie like St. Elmo's Fire as a grown-up, you'll feel this way about the students. I couldn't finish that movie. Come on, get over yourselves. You don't run the world. You're not cute. What you're feeling is not new. You're not suddenly admirable and amazing because you're 22 and you think there's no purpose. I don't know that I'd be on Benjamin Braddock's side if he was up there on the stage being the one true noble soul who gets that life can feel like there's no purpose to it. We've all read Sartre. It turns out that he's imagining this scene, maybe recalling it, if it happened, or dreaming it, because the amphitheater ends up being empty in his little fever dream in the screenplay, and we cut to him on the plane. So maybe this is just what's running through his mind on the plane. Maybe that's how he felt about graduation. But here's what's great about the actual movie. We see all of this. We see the purposelessness and the feeling of existential doubts. We see all of this through the acting and the directing. The movie opens, we're on Dustin Hoffman, handsome young guy, see him in close-up, and then we zoom out, kind of a quick zoom, and we see that he's just another face in the crowd on this plane. The other thing the screenplay does is show that all the screens in the plane are showing static, which again, a little too clever, I think. We don't need to be hit over the head with this stuff. Instead, it's more dramatic, I think, just to have him on a plane where things are going well, and yet he's lost. We don't know who this guy is, but he's obviously our protagonist because we follow him. He gets on the moving walkway, and this is the best part. He doesn't go anywhere. He doesn't get anywhere. He's obviously moving because the background changes, but he doesn't move on our screen. He occupies the same place on the right-hand side of the screen, staring ahead passively. In real life, he's moving. We know that. He's not standing still. But on the screen, because the camera's moving with him, he's frozen in place. People pass him because they're walking and he's not. But it's that feeling that just that little work of the camera the camera moving along with him, him standing still. He's moving, but he's stuck. This is perfect to set the scene and the character. We don't need a speech where he lays all this out at a graduation ceremony. We don't need all that because we can do it just with an actor standing in place on a moving walkway and a camera moving with him. It does the job. He's moving, but he's stuck. Just like it's perfect. He's moving against his will. His feet aren't moving, but he's moving, but he's stuck. It's all there. Just like it's perfect that the airplane has landed in Los Angeles and the pilot announces beautiful, sunny Los Angeles weather and the soundtrack kicks in with The Sound of Silence, Simon and Garfunkel, which of course begins, "Hello, darkness, my old friend." Most people in those days, in any era really, view California as the land of sunshine and delight, happiness. Think of the mamas and papas. The mamas and the papas, their California Dreamin' song. It's probably around the same time. All the leaves are brown and the sky is gray. That's how that song starts. That song is, that part of the song, they're set in the East. That's, they were in New York. That's the East looking toward California. That's New York and Boston and the Eastern College of Benjamin Braddock. California, man, that's the place to be. Here, all the leaves are brown and the sky is gray. I'm dreaming of California. But here's Ben Braddock landing in California, landing in paradise, and the words on the soundtrack are, "Hello, darkness, my old friend." It's the opposite journey. He's moving, but he's standing still. He's in Los Angeles, but he's in the dark. It's a reminder of how life can be. You're succeeding, but you're still unhappy. You're eating, but you're still hungry. You're having sex, but you're not in love. You're in sunshine, surrounded by happy people, but you're not happy. Then you might be in the dark, metaphorically and literally. You're in an airport with no windows, let's say, or you're in a basement, or you're in a hotel with the shades drawn. You're in darkness, right there in the land of the sun, but you're in darkness. Hello, darkness. One more thing about the moving walkway. He's on the right side of the screen facing left. In Western cultures, thanks to our reading of books, movement is left to right. Our eyes scan left to right all the time. That's how we're trained. That's how we make progress. Left to right, left to right, left to right, over and over and over. Moving from right to left works against that. Our brains sense that nothing is happening. You're going the wrong way. Going that way won't get you anywhere. And that's the way he's going. And he's not smiling or laughing or talking. He's just there staring ahead. The music is moving along. The music is compelling. It's not inert. It's not an inert viewing experience. And yet it's showing an inert moment in a life. It's one of the most fascinating openings to a movie I have ever seen, and absolutely nothing is happening. So the screenplay at this point was overwritten, at least at first, but obviously it gets better. Buck Henry gets what Mike Nichols was trying to do, and that is it gets the metaphor. It gets the metaphor that Mike Nichols was going for. Critics didn't get it. Mike Nichols got it. Dustin Hoffman played it through a kind of miracle, and Buck Henry got it too. Let's dig into what we mean by that a little more. Mike Nichols said that for him, a movie was a metaphor. A play was too, but we're talking about movies now. The movie was a metaphor. And the trick in reading a movie or getting ready to reading a screenplay or getting ready to direct a movie, the trick was to find what the metaphor was. It wasn't real life that you're trying to depict. He wasn't trying to depict anything actual. He's trying to depict a variation of life. And he said that a version of life. And he said that one of the reasons he loved black and white films, which he had used for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, he insisted on using black and white. He said he'd quit the picture if Jack Warner insisted on using color. The primary reason for using black and white for that movie was that Elizabeth Taylor was supposed to be playing an older woman. She was only 31 or 32. And he said, in color, her makeup is going to look terrible. We have to use black and white. But the other reason he liked black and white, the reason why he missed it when he had to use color, was that black and white instantly set a mood for the audience. This is a metaphor. You're about to watch a metaphor. This isn't real. If it were real, it'd be in color. This is a representation, a depiction of something that's been created for you with a purpose, with reason, with art. There's going to be something for you to grasp about this. Get ready. And in the case of The Graduate, that metaphor for Nichols was that this was a guy drowning in objects, material objects, and his way out of it was through madness, which he ultimately came up with, ultimately fell into, ultimately achieved. That's it. Let's remind ourselves of the plot. Ben comes home. His parents have bought him a sports car. He has graduate school ahead of him if he wants to go. His parents have a house with a pool. It could be a good summer. He's done well. He deserves a break. But he can barely bring himself to function. He's so full of ennui. His parents want to show him off to their friends at their party. He doesn't want to go. He doesn't want to talk to anybody. Finally, one of these friends, Mrs. Robinson, who is herself in a crumbling marriage, though we don't know that yet, propositions him. He has a panicky rendezvous with her that leads to an affair eventually. He then gets kind of trapped into taking her daughter on a date, which he has to do or risk exposure of the affair. But Mrs. Robinson freaks out and says, "Don't you ever go near my daughter." And he tries to tank the date. It doesn't work. He feels bad about it. And then he has feelings for the daughter, Elaine. And he and Elaine hit it off in a way that he and Mrs. Robinson never have. This part is why I think critics saw it as the generation gap. You don't have anything in common with Mrs. Robinson, that old lady. You have something in common with the young person, like you are, Benjamin Braddock. That's kind of the critic's take on it. Anyway, back to the plot summary. Elaine and Ben talk. They have more in common. Ben's been a little frustrated that he and Mrs. Robinson are having this affair, but all they do is jump into bed together. They never talk about anything. When they do talk, they ships passing in the night. But when Ben starts to see Elaine, Mrs. Robinson freaks out. She's furious at Ben for doing this, but this hardens Ben's resolve because he thinks that she thinks he's not good enough for her daughter. So he tells Elaine. Elaine finds out because just before Mrs. Robinson does, Mrs. Robinson's going to blow it up by informing her. So Elaine finds out about the affair between Ben and her own mother, which should end things between Elaine and Ben. But Ben can't give her up. He ends up following Elaine to Berkeley, convinced that they'll get married. Mrs. Robinson then tells Mr. Robinson another card to play, further way to end it. Elaine gets engaged to be married to another boy, and Ben famously finds out where the wedding will take place, drives there, his car breaks down, he runs to the church, he stands on the balcony screaming her name. Everyone is furious at him for interrupting this wedding, but finally Elaine screams his name too. The two of them leave. He fights off the parents and the guests with a cross, a handy weapon in a church, by the way, especially if you're looking for symbols. He sticks the cross in the door handle to keep the mob inside, and then the two sprint to a bus, board the bus, and the bus pulls out, the two of them victorious. But what comes next? We don't know. That's where the movie ends. Okay, that's the plot. Basically, that's the plot of the book as well. Follows it pretty closely. Critics watched the film and said, like I said before, it's about the generation gap. The generation, the kids. These are kids, baby boomers, getting older, rejecting the lifestyles of their parents. Ben sleeps with the mother, but rejects her generation. He doesn't want plastics. rejects them just as he's rejecting his parents. And as Elaine is rejecting her parents, these are the youth. They're going to do things their own way, even if that means they'll throw conventionality aside or and live on the edge without a safety net, but also live without rules and restrictions and the grasping for wealth that the older generation was holding out before them like a shiny bauble. Nichols was after a different movie than that. Exactly. That's not the only thing on his mind. And I think he made a different movie than that, though all that is kind of there. But I think it's more about Ben's struggle to escape his wealth and these material objects and the future that would involve plastics and so on. And Charles, it's not just a generation gap. It's about escaping that, even if your own generation is going for it too. And Charles Webb, as we'll hear, was even more determined than Ben to do the same. That governed the rest of Charles Webb's life. Now, Nichols uses some incredible camera work to make all this lively. It doesn't sound like that lively of a story. It does have an affair, but a lot of it is about feeling lost, feeling dejected, feeling adrift. That could be a quiet movie. That could be a boring movie. But this is live. The montages are amazing, and the overlay of the Simon and Garfunkel songs work perfectly. Now, that happened almost by a fluke. Nichols got the album from his... This was Simon and Garfunkel's first album. Nichols got the album from his brother and listened to it every morning before he went into the studio to work on the film. Finally, after 3 weeks, he thought, well, this is my score, these songs. This is what I'm thinking. This is the movie I'm making. It works. It fits. So he started laying down the songs over the footage that he was editing, and he said that this only happened once or twice in his entire career, that he put a song down over a particular sequence that he had already edited. In this case, it was the famous sequence where we see Ben at his parents' house, in bed and in the pool, and it's interwoven with his trips to see Mrs. Robinson. So we sort of see what his life is like for these weeks as he's having this affair at night, but having his days in silence, barely talking to his parents. They don't understand him. He doesn't understand himself. And he's living this life in this with this pool, this swimming pool. We see the passage of time through this, but the two lives he's living kind of blur together, just as his life is blurred together. These parallel lives that he's living by day and by night. And Nichols and his editor cut that sequence where he's coming out of the pool and onto the raft, but he actually ends up in bed. You remember this part? Nichols and his editor cut that sequence. Then they put the song down over it. And Nichols said later that it fit perfectly, shot by shot, note by note, to the second. They didn't have to change a thing. That's some movie karma there. Another bit of cinematic karma with the soundtrack. This is a great story too. He asked Simon and Garfunkel for a song for Mrs. Robinson. And they wrote one and came in with it. And Nichols said, well, I don't like it. What else do you have? Give me the next one. And they said, well, no, that's the only one we wrote. And Nichols said, well, we can't use it, so now what do we do? Thought you were going to write a bunch for me to pick from. You only gave me one, and I don't like it, so what do we do now? And they said, well, we don't know. And then Simon pulled Garfunkel aside, and the two of them whispered to each other in the corner for a moment. And then they came back and started playing and singing. And what they were singing is what you all know as the song, And Here's to You, Mrs. Robinson. A classic, classic song. It was fully done. And Nichols listened to that and said, what the hell? How did you do that? What's going on? And they said, well, we've been working on this song called Here's to You, Mrs. Roosevelt. And we just realized I guess we could change that to Mrs. Robinson if you want it for the movie. And Nichols said, of course I want it for the movie. The song is perfect. And you hear in the movie where they sang without words. That's because they didn't have the words yet. All they had was the chorus. And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. But it works. Again, it's perfect. It's movie magic. So, one more piece of movie magic, and then we'll talk about the book and Roger Ebert. We have to talk about the ending. The book ends with them getting on the bus. Wisely, the movie follows that too. It's a good ending. The church and then the bus. But the ending we see is not the ending. The ending we see in the movie is not the ending Nichols and Buck Henry envisioned when they wrote the screenplay. What they had in mind was the bus pulling out. There's some dialogue in the screenplay. The driver says, how far do you want to go? And Ben says, to the end. This doesn't make it into the movie. It's not necessary. What we see in the film is that the two of them race onto the bus ahead of the mob. They rush back to the back seat. She's in her bridal gown and he's sitting next to her. They're both breathing hard, sweaty, exhilarated. And there are people in the background as the bus pulls away. And everyone on the bus is turned around to stare at them, which is kind of a funny moment. The screenplay ends like that. The book ends like that too. In the book, she says, Benjamin. And Ben says, what? That's the last line of the book, which is very good. What, Ben said, the bus began to move. That's how the book ends. In the screenplay, the bus pulls out and we see the church receding in the distance with some men in suits rushing around as the bus pulls away. But in the movie, there's something else. In the movie, we hold on the two of them and they look happy for a moment, thinking about the escape, clearly. Bit of a smile to think about how crazy that was and how they made it. But then the smiles fade and a bit of anxiety sets in, maybe a little fear. What's going to happen now? What the hell is going to happen now? They threw over convention. This is what the critics didn't really get. The younger generation cast aside the older one. Fine, that's an interpretation. But it's not an unadulterated triumph, no pun intended. Once you cast aside materiality and convention and tradition and family and the cocoon of safety and following expectations, what then? What? Love? Will that last? Excitement? Will that pay the bills? Who or what will these people be now? The movie captures all of that with the length of time that the shot holds and the looks on their faces. It gets away from the generation gap metaphor and into the Nichols metaphor that this isn't just an escape. It's an escape via madness. It's a dream that is their reality, and the dream might be a nightmare. What you've done is crazy. There's reason for hope, but also reason for fear. It's a perfect, perfect ending. And it was a total fluke. A random accident, a lucky break that happened on the set. Here's what happened. They were getting to the end of filming. They had to get this scene right. The pressure was on. The police agreed to block off 20 blocks for the bus so they could film that final scene on the bus. They weren't going to be able to hold those 20 blocks open indefinitely. A lot of pressure. Not a good time to run out of film or fiddle with lighting or have trouble with the actors. And so Nichols, who had been very patient with Ben and Elaine Hoffman in his first movie, and Catherine Ross, who was also pretty young. He had been very patient with them, an angel, a dream director the whole time, except for now. He was abrupt with them for the first time that he had been throughout the shooting. Before they shot the scene, he snapped at them out of his own fear and anxiety about what was happening with the police and the 20 blocks and the pressure they were under. And he said, "Can you just get this right on the first take? Can you just get in the seats, laugh, and not screw things up and let us get something we can use?" He was sharper in tone than he had been before, and they looked like they might cry. This director friend of theirs, the congenial guy they had come to love, they had been collaborating this whole time, and suddenly that guy was gone, replaced by this tyrant. And he saw it on their faces, and he apologized. He said, "Don't worry, I'm sorry, it'll be fine," and so on. And then, but something lingered with them about this experience. And when he saw the footage, he couldn't believe what was on their faces. He thought they would look excited and joyous. The two lovebirds had escaped, happy ending, on their way to their future. But what he saw that they didn't look just excited and joyous. As their acting wore off, as they waited for the 20 blocks to finish and the cameras kept rolling, something else settled in. He saw the emotion that he himself had just introduced by yelling at them prior to the shot. "My God," he said to himself, "they're terrified." And they had been terrified of him, of disappointing him, of making him angry. But it was perfect for the characters in the movie, too. They were happy and excited, but they were also terrified. Works. It's movie magic. There's a lot more we could say about the movie, but I want to leave it there because we're running long and we're moving on to the growing old with part of the growing old with the graduate that I have in mind. There are two ways to look at this. One is that we as a society have grown older. The movie is no longer an infant. It's well into middle age now. But also, there's the way of people who watch it when they're young might see it differently from people the same people who rewatch it when they've gotten older. Famously, this happened to Roger Ebert. I've seen it recently and can offer my thoughts as well. Ebert and I differ on how the movie affected us in our different viewings, but first, let me remind you of one of my favorite pieces of literary criticism, which I can't find now to quote, but I'm almost certain that it was Wayne Booth and that he was talking about reading Anna Karenina three times at three different periods in his life. When he was 20, he read of Anna Karenina and her relationship with the older man, and he thought, no, why is she throwing her life away with this old guy? And when he was 40, he read the same book, and he thought, how nice, he will teach her. And when he was 60, he thought, what on earth are these young people doing? Three different reads. Anna Karenina didn't change. Wayne Booth changed. 20, 40, 60. Roger Ebert's first review was contemporaneous, 1967. Quote, "The Graduate, the funniest American comedy of the year, is inspired by the free spirit which the young British directors have brought into their movies. It is funny, not because of sight gags and punchlines and other tired rubbish, but because it has a point of view." End quote. He goes on to say that Mike Nichols had announced himself as a major new director. And he says, quote, "He introduces us to a young college graduate, Dustin Hoffman, who returns to a ferociously stupid upper-middle-class California suburb. He would like the chance to sit around and think about his future for several months. You know, think," end quote. Ebert, I should point out, was 25 when the movie came out. He was 3 years younger than the novelist Charles Webb. He's pretty close to the age that Hoffman is playing in the movie. This is Ebert's generation. Benjamin Braddock is Ebert's generation, and you can hear that in his review. Here's a graduate who's stuck in a ferociously stupid upper-middle-class California suburb, and hey, all the guy wants to do is think, people. Come on, you stupid grown-ups. You know, think. You can hear Ebert rooting for Ben in the same way that young people root for Holden Caulfield. You're all phonies. Can't I just do something that's not phony? Can't I just, you know, think? Do I have to get jobs like you, laugh at your jokes, become you? Is there some law against thinking? And here's where the young me is sort of with Roger and Ben on this, but also at my age, on my first viewing and who I was at the time, when I was that age, I guess, when I was like 20, 22, in college, I kind of thought, well, yeah, okay, he wants to think. Why didn't he get a job? He wants the right to be left alone and think. Well, he wants that while living in his parents' house, swimming in their pool, paying for hotels for his affairs with his parents' money, driving the sports car they bought him. Okay, he wants to think. Well, if he earned that right, he could think all he wants. That was kind of my view. But let's get back to Ebert. He's a hero of mine. Don't get me wrong. But he gets things wrong sometimes. And listen to this ending. Nichols stays on top of his material. He never pauses to make sure we're getting the point. He never explains for the slow-witted. He never apologizes. Okay, that's good. Nice job, Raj. Ebert goes on to say, his only flaw, I believe, is the introduction of limp, wordy Simon and Garfunkel songs and arty camera work to suggest the passage of time between major scenes. Wow. Even Roger nods. Otherwise, Roger says, The Graduate is a success and Benjamin's acute honesty and embarrassment are so accurately drawn that we hardly know whether to laugh or to look inside ourselves. Okay. Pretty good review. 4 stars. Limp and wordy Simon and Garfunkel songs. LOL, Roger. May you RIP. Okay. So what happened? Did Roger at age... when he revisited The Graduate, age 45 or so, suddenly joined the 20-year-old me in thinking that Ben's problem was that he had not really earned the right to be so angsty and full of himself? Well, is that what the older... I guess I was an old soul when I was young. That was me. Or maybe that was just because that was me having lived through the 70s and 80s and seen... I had a different sensibility. Saw some of those boomers selling out. Saw some of, had the sort of feeling that you have to work for a living, have to work to earn the right to be angsty. Did Roger think that when he got older? Well, he thought that and more. Actually, he was 55 when he revisited The Graduate in a second review. What did he think of The Graduate then? Well, he knocks it down a star from 4 stars to 3 and says, this is how the review begins. Quote, well, here is to you, Mrs. Robinson. You've survived your defeat at the hands of that insufferable creep, Benjamin, and emerged as the most sympathetic and intelligent character in The Graduate. How could I have ever thought otherwise? What murky generational politics were distorting my view the first time I saw this film? End quote. How great is that? Raj is on a roll. He says, lesser movies are captives of their time. They get dated and lose their original focus and power. The Graduate, I can see clearly now, is a lesser movie. It comes out of a specific time in the late 1960s when parents stood for stodgy middle-class values and the kids were joyous rebels at the cutting edge of the sexual and political revolutions. Benjamin Braddock, Dustin Hoffman, the clueless hero of The Graduate, was swept in on that wave of feeling, even though it is clear today that he was utterly unaware of his generation and existed outside time and space. He seems most at home at the bottom of a swimming pool. End quote. The Graduate, Roger says, the review says, released in 1967, contains no flower children, no hippies, no dope, no rock music, no political manifestos, and no danger. It is a movie about a tiresome bore and his well-meaning parents. That's a 55-year-old looking at the 20-something. The only character in the movie who is alive, who can see through situations, understand motives, and dare to seek her own happiness is Mrs. Robinson. Seen today, The Graduate is a movie about a young man of limited interest who gets the chance to sleep with the ranking babe in his neighborhood and throws it away in order to marry her dorky daughter, end quote. This is fascinating. And Roger diagnoses the problem I have with the movie, and I think society has too, as The Graduate gets older Or maybe I should say, as we get older and the graduate stays the same, what's getting older here? What's getting older? Is the graduate getting older because it came out in 1967? Would we say that the graduate is 50-some years old? I guess, but also the graduate hasn't changed. The rest of us have. It's like time is a moving walkway. And art is the one standing still. Very interesting. Okay, let me insert a parenthesis here before we leave the wealth issue behind. There are two issues here. The angst that's produced my materialism and the solution via the affairs with the mother and daughter. That's just the plot. Let's look at the materialism first. I'm with Ben on the idea that you can be drowning in materialism and feel like life has no point. But if someone wants to complain about that, it falls on deaf ears for me, unless they're giving up the wealth at the same time. And Charles Webb, the author, the Williams grad, didn't just talk the talk on that one. He was walking the walk, and he did so for all of his life. Webb is a fascinating guy. He based Ben on himself, not on an actual affair that he had, but some fantasies he had after graduating, and he returned home to California with no idea what to do. Other than that, he didn't want to join the world of his father's medical practice. In real life, it was a medical practice. In the film, it's a law practice. He didn't want to join all the backyard swimming pool parties and swanky cocktails and the kind of swinger lifestyle that made the suburbs in the 60s seem so Playboy mansion type Hugh Hefner attractive, but also kind of cheap and desperate. Webb saw the need for an escape from that. But what you might think is, okay, well, then he became a novelist and he wrote a mega hit. He got rich that way, etc., etc. In the world of baby boomers writing about the horrible problem of material wealth, well, that was a golden goose that nobody wanted to kill. You could get rich writing books like that. Why not just write books and movies expressing the guilt and horror of getting rich? Tap into that feeling. And then actually get rich doing so. Feel good about your tormented soul all the way to the bank. Webb was different. He made $1,000 on the film version of The Graduate. He made $20,000 from The Graduate total. That was all. None of his other novels sold much either. And in a way, it wouldn't have mattered because he would have given all the money away. Here's an article from The Independent. It shows Webb at home in East Sussex, where he wound up. After living in his car for a while, a VW bus, he was at a shelter for a while, he and his wife. And they show a photo of him late in life. He's living in a tiny box of an apartment with almost no possessions. There's a really uninspiring carpet, a chair, another chair that on closer look is a single futon bed that is apparently where he sleeps. There's a computer and some headphones. No other possessions at all in this little room. That's his life, this guy who wrote the source material for one of the greatest comedies in the history of Hollywood. The headline is Charles Webb, the graduate author who ended up living in poverty. The subhead is, the writer distanced himself from the movie adaptation's huge success and throughout his life championed an anti-materialist philosophy. End quote. Something that I cannot shake, Webb once said of The Graduate, the novel. It has defined my whole life. I just want to run away. Webb, who became famous but not wealthy from The Graduate, went on to write a slew of additional novels while championing an anti-materialist philosophy and living in poverty. He and his wife, Eve, gave away most of their possessions and worked odd jobs, moving between campgrounds, trailer parks, nudist colonies, and motels before settling in England. Millions and millions were made from The Graduate, and here I am, Webb told the BBC in 2006, amid a flurry of news coverage about his dire financial straits, searching around for a couple of quid to buy my sandwich. People love that. Eve was the real-life inspiration for Elaine. Charles and Eve struggled with their privileged backgrounds. She was the daughter of prep school teachers. He went to Williams. She went to Bennington. And they tried giving away everything to find meaning in life. They never shared in the film's profits or in the proceeds from subsequent stage adaptations, says the article. He donated the book's copyright to the Anti-Defamation League and went on to sell or donate nearly everything else he had as well, including art by Robert Rauschenberg and Andy Warhol, a $65,000 home in the Berkshires, and another house outside New York City. For a time, he and his family lived in a Volkswagen bus, crisscrossing the country and parking wherever they could. The Webbs homeschooled their two children, and although they divorced in the early 1980s in protest of the institution of marriage, remained together, supporting themselves by washing dishes, cleaning houses, picking fruit, working in supermarkets, and presiding over a nudist camp in New Jersey. In all fairness, I think Charles and I have gone overboard because of our upbringing, his partner and former wife, the daughter of prep school teachers, told the Associated Press in 1992. It was devoid of goals or any ideal of doing something for society. We were taught that the only contribution anybody could make was to make money. They married in 1962 and soon sold off their wedding gifts, horrifying family members. Eve, an artist, later changed her name to Fred, explaining that she aimed to express solidarity with a support group for men with low self-esteem. Fred eventually died. The two had split up by then, but Charles still cared for her. He died a year later in 2020. His entire life, he insisted that he did not regret not taking more money from the success of The Graduate. He said, if I had $100 million, it wouldn't have taken me that much longer to spend than $20,000, and that would have been a whole lifetime's work getting rid of that much, he told the blog ThoughtCat in 2006. I think I would have been bitter to get that much money, he added. I think I'd be a bitter old man at this point. I'm sure I'd still be shoveling it out the door. Now, I don't resent any artists for taking the money. I don't think it tarnishes their art. Might be tarnished by a decision to write for the market or whatever, but the art stands alone on itself. If it's good, it's good. If not, it's not. And in fact, his book is not even that good. A fictional failure, the New York Times book critic said, and I agree. It raises questions about the psychological motivation of its hero and makes no effort to answer them, end quote. But although I think the Peanuts comic strip is still good, even though Charles Schulz allowed the marketing of Snoopy and Charlie Brown until they're about as ubiquitous as winter snow. And I don't blame Schulz as a person for doing it. I still give Bill Watterson some credit for not doing the same with Calvin and Hobbes. He wanted the strips collected into books to stand on their own without having to be dug out from an avalanche of stuffed animals and greeting cards and cartoons watering them down. And I respect that too. I don't think Bill Watterson's a sucker for not taking the money. I think he's admirable. And part of me likes the comics more, knowing that they're a little special because their creator cared about them enough to make it so. I don't really like Ben Braddock all that much, but I like The Graduate more, knowing that Ben Braddock's creator really did feel this kind of torment about the California suburbs and material objects there and wealth and privilege, and that he really did give them up. It makes me think that Ben didn't end up having it both ways, rich and yet admirable for his guilty conscience. He had the guilty conscience and was poor. So that takes care of one thing about The Graduate that prevents me from calling it a perfect movie. The wealth, the privilege that other nonconformists like Jack Kerouac don't really address in their books, that they actually had money. They were living off of the work of others. Relatives were sending them money. They weren't free spirits. It was free for them. It cost something for someone else. Well, that always bothers me, but I'm willing to give it a pass in this case because Charles Webb basically lived in Ben's misery for his entire adult life. The hypocrisy is diluted by that. The other problem, though, with The Graduate that I have is a tough one. Ebert puts his finger on it in his second review, the one he wrote when he was 55. He says, quote, "Consider for a moment the character of Elaine, Mrs. Robinson's daughter. She has no dialogue of any depth. She has an alarming fetish for false eyelashes. She agrees to marry a tall blonde jock, mostly because her parents will be furious with her if she doesn't. She is so witless that she misunderstands everything Benjamin says to her. When she discovers Benjamin has slept with her mother, she is horrified, but before they have ever had a substantial conversation about the subject, she has forgiven him, apparently because Mrs. Robinson is so hateful that it couldn't have been Benjamin's fault. She then escapes from the altar at her own wedding to flee with Benjamin on a bus, where they look at each other nervously, perhaps because they are still to have a meaningful conversation," end quote. Well, Raj is getting a little carried away. He's defending Mrs. Robinson and how misunderstood she was and so on. And I think he exaggerates a little bit. We did see a conversation. We didn't get to hear it, but we did see that Ben and Elaine had a conversation when they're eating hamburgers. I think Raj still doesn't seem to really understand the movie. He's fixated on the generation gap, just seeing it from the other side. Probably because other critics saw the movie that way too, and all their commentary was hard to shake. But he says this, "Today, looking at The Graduate, I see Benjamin not as an admirable rebel, but as a self-centered creep whose put-downs of adults are tiresome," end quote. That sounds like Wayne Booth. A 55-year-old looking at a younger kid is irritated, just like the guy at the gym is cranky with my teenager when my teenager is sitting on a weight machine in between sets. The old guy assumes the young kid is rebellious, when maybe all he's doing is pausing for breath. But Ben, here's what Raj gets right. Ben is a creep. He basically stalks Elaine, and there's no reason that we're given for Elaine to want to be with him. We see nothing in Ben that would outweigh the very real problem that here's a guy who slept with her mother, which is going to complicate the rest of her life. There are other men in the world to date. She has no end of them at Berkeley, and Berkeley, there would surely be other Bens up there too. There would be men who, if she's with Ben because he's so willing to give up material things, she could find that at Berkeley too. There's nothing special about Ben that we've seen in the movie other than that he's insisting on marrying her. And he's not even the only guy who's offered to do that. If you say to me, "You're wrong, Jack Wilson. Here's why Elaine likes Ben," and then you give the reason, I will ask you, is that reason in the movie, or did you supply it? And if you supplied it, why didn't the movie give us that? They do nothing for Elaine. It's all Ben. When I was younger, this was a trope. The young man in love who just tries really, really hard to persuade the girl of his dreams to fall for him. And eventually he holds up the boombox over his head, or he shows up over and over, and by insisting, he gets his way. She relents. Why? Why would she do that? Because this guy will love her more than anyone else will? Well, that's his argument. I have a different view of whether this really happens in real life, or if it does happen, whether that's even a very good foundation for a relationship. You can get to this point through friendship without all the creepy stalker aspects and the ugly insisting. Ben could have backed off and been friends with Elaine, or just left her alone. There was no reason for him to insert himself into Elaine's life like this. Are we getting married today? No? Well, then how about tomorrow? How about the next day? We might? There's no reason for Ben to do that just because he wanted to. Like I said, I doubt it happens this way very much in real life. It leads to a happy ending. If it does happen, I doubt if it ends well, but here's something I don't doubt. A whole generation of young men growing up with this ethos in the 60s and 70s and 80s probably harassed a lot of women who had to explain to them that no, thank you. Playing the guitar outside my window is not going to be enough. Please stop and go home. Really, please stop. And the guys think, but I'm being romantic. And in the movies, That's the part that stands out. Elaine is beautiful and seems very nice. Ben is cruel to her at first and has had this affair with her mom. Two strikes for Ben. Even if Elaine's not a prude about the affair, even if she can get over that, why should she? What's Ben done to earn that? How limited is she that she can't reject Ben as well as the guy at the altar? A scene or two could have fixed this. Could have given us Elaine's motivation, could have explained things, but those scenes would have been about her, and the movie is locked into Ben, his journey, his anti-materialism, his madness, Robinson's Elaine and Mrs. are just in his way. That's a flaw for me. But I'm okay with some flaws. Perfection is hard to come by, after all. I wouldn't say Penny Lane is a perfect song, necessarily, but it is darn close, and I smile every single time I hear it. And The Graduate is like that, too. Plenty to love about this movie. So I'm ending where I started. This movie by Mike Nichols, who presided over a number of happy accidents in bringing this thing into being. This movie is alive to the world, even when the characters in the movie aren't. And that's the beauty of art. The reminder through metaphor and artifice and the power of creativity of the endless possibilities of life, including the watching and enjoying and appreciating of artistic works like this one. I asked listeners recently for examples of awe. If literature ever made you feel the way that thunderstorms do and starry skies and the oceans rolling in under a sunrise. Did you ever feel that there was something bigger than you previously thought there was? Something transcendent? Did literature take you there? I've shared a few responses with you so far. One I haven't shared yet came on Twitter with a listener who said the end of Kerouac's On the Road was like that. And I get it. That's a book about a full tank of gas and wide open skies. And the ending is incredibly uplifting, motivating. Makes you want to get out there and live like a comet or a firework, because we're all comets and fireworks. We burn brightly and then we fade. And another response that I haven't shared yet is from Chris in California, who writes, "Dear Jack, on the subject of literary awe, I'll put in my 2 cents for the book I finished last night, The Man Who Watched Trains Go by George Simenon. What makes it awe-worthy? Insomnia. Once I finished, my mind began racing and it just wouldn't stop. The existentialist theme struck a chord. Simenon's style and grace never fails. And the very last sentence rang true. I didn't expect that the book would affect me, and maybe that's the nature of literary awe. You don't see it coming. Yours, Chris." Maybe that's the nature of literary awe. You don't see it coming. Like the powerful end of a movie, like the powerful end of a novel, like the perfect word in the perfect place, the surprise of it, but the inevitable surprise of it, as Flannery O'Connor would say. The lid snaps shut tight and it's satisfying. You were not expecting that, but now you see that it's perfect. Or perfect enough, and it reminds you that there's a perfection in life worth chasing too. An ugly, ragged, raw perfection, but a real perfection, more genuine and true, because it's you in the middle of it. Your body and heart and mind, not just your brain. You're out there living. The Graduate is like On the Road. They're both about moving, getting away, escaping, becoming. Both are works of art, obviously. which in a way is better than life, but life can get the job done too. Both works are about possibilities. The graduate is an on the road where the car literally breaks down, which is very true to life. But then you get out and run, because that's true to life too. If you feel it at age 20 or 40 or 55 or 60, you get out and run to those possibilities as long as you can and as fast as you can and as far, as beautifully, wonderfully far. Okay, that's going to do it for this episode of the History of Literature. Prattle, prattle, prattle. Hey, Mr. Wilson, well, what can I say? I'm an incorrigible rambler. I get on a roll sometimes, and an episode unfurls before I know what's hit me. I did not expect this. I did want to do an episode about The Graduate. I did not know it was going to be that. Ah, well, yet another darling for me to someday kill. I'm telling you, I like these episodes at the time. It's only afterwards that I groan with embarrassment now that they're over, and this one has no guests, which makes me groan all the more. Just Jack Wilson, blah, blah, blah. The guests are the secret to the show, the redemption. Like Marion Turner last time. I'm not going to apologize for that episode, for letting you hear more of her. That's doing some good in the world. Giving her the microphone. We've got more good guests coming up soon too, so stay tuned for those. Please do follow us, which is what they say instead of subscribe these days. Follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and wherever you get your podcasts. And tell all your friends, etc. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.